This is the Pure Green Podcast, Episode 5. The way we eat is simply a series of habits, a quotidian cycle we all live by. While eating a clean and pure diet may feel aspirational, it's nothing but a rearranging of those daily habits until they become the rituals around which your day takes place. Inside our guest Amy Chaplin's kitchen, those rituals ebb and flow around a well-stocked pantry, soaking nuts, seeds, or grains daily to tease out hidden nutritional benefit. She teaches you how to turn new habits into rituals and eventually into a way of being. Come meet her. You're gonna love her. Welcome. I'm excited about today's episode. I'm excited about all our episodes because each is an opportunity for me to grow and learn as I conduct these interviews. Today's guest is Amy Chaplin, the celebrated author of At Home in the Whole Food Kitchen, which was just released this fall to much praise. Deborah Madison calls it beautiful and inspiring. Natalie Portman calls it a culinary delight and guide for good health and uses the book to personally prepare meals for her family. Not that I needed a celebrity testament to convince me, as Amy's book carried me away on its own merits. It's been sitting on my nightstand for weeks now. I'm reading it as a primer to refresh my knowledge and learn many new things as well. Part one of the book focuses on a well-stocked pantry, where Amy shares how to properly prepare grains, beans, nuts, and seeds, which superfoods you should have on hand, and basic recipes to rely on. It's fascinating. I'm completely enthralled. In our interview, Amy shares why, for example, soaking nuts, seeds, and grains is rather imperative for good health. What I like best about these podcasts is that each one feels like a conversation between friends. Soon I forget the formality of the interview, the microphone I'm sitting in front of, and become totally absorbed in simply getting to know someone and bringing you along with me. The conversations are meant to feel informal, and I hope you feel like you're getting to know both of us on that personal level too. Amy's interview is no different. We talk in depth about her unique childhood and how it laid the foundation for a career in food. She shares how she lived and traveled around the world before coming to New York, where she now lives, and her food journey and learning along the way. She shares what it was like to work as the executive chef at one of New York's most prestigious vegan restaurants, Angelica Kitchen. And, of course, she takes us inside writing her book. It was a meticulous 2-year journey, not for the faint of heart. I was over the moon when Amy agreed to come on the show. I won't carry on for too long. I'll let Amy take you away. Thanks for listening. So first of all, I have to say thank you so very much for being a part of this. I'm really, really excited.
Thanks for having me.
That's great. And you're one of my culinary food heroes. I love your work. And then your new book, it's fabulous. I hope the response has been, I know it's been fantastic for you.
Oh, yeah. Thank you so much. It has been a really exciting time.
I've had it sitting next to my bedside table for a couple of weeks now, and I'm reading it. I've never done that before with a cookbook, but I really appreciate all of the information and the advice that you have in there. So it's great.
Oh, thank you so much.
So I wanted to begin, Amy, by going over your childhood just a little bit. In the beginning, in the foreword of your book, you do a really beautiful job of describing your childhood. Many of the same core principles were instilled in me as a child, and I could really identify with those experiences, minus living in a warm climate, unfortunately. So I wondered if you could paint a similar picture for our listeners, just of what it was like for you growing up and how it laid the foundation for your whole career in food.
Yeah, I grew up in northern New South Wales, Australia, in a remote community that was kind of a group of families that had gotten together and moved out of the city, mostly from Melbourne in, south of Australia. And so my parents were the same. They'd sort of bought a piece of property and wanted to live off the land and just liked the idea of building their own house and, growing what they eat. I really don't think they had any idea what they were in for, but they joined this sort of small community farm and everybody built their own homes there. So we all had this sort of central cabin that people lived in while they were building their homes, and everyone sort of helped build each other's homes. Every week they would sort of work on a different one. So I was sort of very much a part of this supportive community, and everybody cooked and ate what they grew because there wasn't really any choices. So, you know, we'd do these weekly shopping trips, but, you know, you had to go sort of pretty far to get health foods anyway. And so my mother would order everything bulk so that we could have, you know, good quality grains and beans and things on hand. But everything else we grew, besides fruits, there were a lot of tropical fruits in the area, even though right where I grew up, you know, we couldn't actually grow bananas or mangoes or avocados, but just down the mountain from where I lived, they were in abundance. So we really had a great sort of mixture of climates around us. And so we had great food, and therefore people were really creative just because there weren't, you know, restaurant options or takeout or anything like that. So the way I grew up really did just instill in me, I think, the real true good flavor of well-prepared whole foods. I mean, a lot has to do with how you make them, of course, and my mother is an amazing cook, so that helped. But I also feel like there's a lot of other great cooks in the community as well. Everybody seemed to sort of have their specialty, and everybody shared a lot of food. So it really gave me the foundation for the way I love to celebrate food, I think, just the community that surrounded me and my family.
Yeah, so what were some of the weekly rituals or things that you did every single week?
Right, well, my parents, I mean, there were stages where they did, like, they would go through phases. My mother would make ginger beer, or then she'd keep bees, and then for a few years she kept bees, and we would, you know, collect the honey, and then everybody received, like, this. We'd have huge jars of honey. I mean, just so many from so few hives. It was kind of crazy. And that was, like, that wasn't weekly, but that was like a fiasco when it happened. We'd get bees in our hair and, you know, run down to the river screaming and dive in the water to get them off. And, you know, that was like one phase. And then my father always made bread in the beginning, in the early days. He would make, you know, wholemeal bread that I would help him with. And so we'd grind, you know, the grain to make the bread. And my mother made tofu. And I was just telling somebody recently that she used to use the water from the tofu to wash the floors. Yeah, there's a lot of things happen. So mainly, though, it was vegetables. I mean, you know, I just remember picking Brussels sprouts from the garden and broccoli, and we had fennel growing out of control and cherry tomatoes in summer everywhere. And I mean, I'd just snack on things in the garden all the time because my parents were in the garden a lot, composting and weeding. And, you know, it was sort of just like we'd go and socialize in the garden. So I just tasted and sampled constantly. And I think I just remember at a young age being really curious about the combinations of herbs and, you know, what happens, you know, just sort of like I almost like the sort of witchy aspect of, you know, herbal mixtures and things like that, like in my children's books and combined with the garden. And, you know, there was these books that I talk about in my cookbook, which were Jill Barklem. She's like a British illustrator and a storybook author. And she draws these amazing intricate drawings of these mice that live in these sort of intricate root systems underground, and they all have like fires burning and, you know, like jars of jam that they make and collect the berries for in their kitchens, and they're really productive and kind of cozy. And I always just sort of dreamt about having a kitchen like that, which is funny. I mean, that was really young, so that's like 5 years old, and I never thought I'd be a chef. I never ever said that, but I was always really interested in making food and sort of what the feelings that it conjured. That's really what drew me into the kitchen, I think.
Mm-hmm. There's so many directions I could go from here, but I love that one of your early memories is making bread with your father. I had one of the same, and it was just such a wonderful thing, a point of connection. And it sounds really, I have to admit, growing up that way sounds really idyllic, but I'm sure there were challenges too. Yeah. Did you find that?
Oh, yeah, of course. I mean, just like in any family or any community, I mean, there are challenges. I mean, I think growing up like that, I had maybe, I don't know, but for me, it gave me like this real desire to travel. Like I was just so drawn to cities and I just wanted to just sort of be in the middle of it all. And I just loved it when we went to Sydney or Melbourne or, you know, any city. And then I just was really curious about the world. And I don't know that that comes from being isolated, but it was pretty isolated. I mean, there was like 24 children in the school. And, you know, I remember like if you didn't really like that school, you had no choice. And at some point we actually moved part time so that I could go to a Steiner school. My mother's very involved in like the Steiner education system, and my sister actually went right through. But there really was like not a good choice of a high school, so we moved an hour away so that we could go to a Steiner school, and then I could go to a better high school. So yeah, there were those challenges, you know. And then it was hard for us because we missed that house that we built, but it's still there now, and you know, we all visit whenever we can. But I think that was a challenge, you know, just not having that, you know, those choices for schools or, you know, that kind of thing. Unless you homeschooled. I mean, no one was really homeschooling in that area then, although mm-hmm. I'm sure I would have done it if I'd had the choices.
I was actually homeschooled.
Oh, right.
Yeah, not all the way through, just through, I think, from grade 3 to grade 7. And so it was a fabulous experience. And I'm trying to figure out right now if it was something I could do with my daughter, but I'm not sure it is. But, you know, it was wonderful. So then you lived there throughout your whole childhood, or you said you moved away, but how old were you when you moved there?
I was probably 11 or almost 12 when we moved to part time to go to other schools. Yeah. So mm-hmm. for the first like 11, 12 years of my life, we were in this remote place. And, you know, I had plenty of friends. We had like a great community. So I never really felt like I was missing out. But I think going to a different school that has like this alternative system really opened up my mind creatively. Like I think I just had this sort of explosion of like, I mean, just in all directions. I mean, because, you know, you do so much with Steiner. You do, you know, wax carving and mask making and painting and cooking and, you know, travel. And, you know, we just did so much. So I think it was a really, really great experience for me at that time. It was a hard adjustment at first, but yeah, I think it also sort of gave me a lot of confidence creatively that I wasn't given at the other school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that's a big part of what's missing in education, I think, is that spark of creativity and the freedom to pursue what your passions are.
Yeah, and to be able to go deep. That's the thing. You have these 3-week blocks where you just sort of delve into a topic, and I feel like then you really get to experience it as a kid, you mm-hmm. know, it really, yeah. So that was a great experience. But then, yeah, so then I lived, it was a small country town. I mean, when I'm talking about we moved away, it was like down the mountain. And, you know, there's one little town in between. And this is like very alternative kind of small town with still only 2 schools, a high school and a primary school. So it just had a lot of, I mean, a bigger, more vibrant community probably, but it was still not by any means like a city. So.
Right. And you said you were drawn to cities, and I know that you eventually moved to Sydney, was it?
Yes, Sydney first.
Yeah, yeah. And so then how old were you at that point?
I was 16.
Oh, really?
I left school. I left home really young and moved to Sydney just sort of thinking I would go back to school when I found the right school for myself, which was going to be performing arts. I was really into performing arts. So I but then in the meantime, I had to work. So I worked in this cafe in Sydney and met someone that would be my business partner in London in years in the future, like 5 years in the future. So that was sort of like one of those chance sort of karmic meetings. And we stayed in touch. And eventually when I moved to Amsterdam, I would visit her in London, and her and her husband lived there. And then I eventually moved in with them and started a business. But anyway, that's fast forward. But yeah, I did. I started in Sydney, and then I was just like, you know, me and my best friend were just like, let's travel. So we just saved money, and I was 17 when I left and moved to Amsterdam.
And you said in your book that living in Sydney and the people that you were surrounded by your friends and social circle. That's where you got your introduction to
biotics.
Macrobiotic nutrition. So could you explain a little bit what that is?
Yeah, well, I feel like I hadn't, you know, we grew up eating like, you know, vegetarian and very healthy, but I really was drawn to macrobiotics because, well, for one, there was this small restaurant in Sydney in Glebe called Iku, which is now a chain, but back in the day it was just one place and the food was just beautiful. I mean, very macrobiotic diet is based, you know, it's pretty much vegan, although because it's based on home-cooked Japanese food, you can include a bit of fish, and sometimes people actually even include meat, but mainly it's grains and vegetables and seaweeds, and everything is cooked just because it's easier to digest that way. And, you know, they originally, well, actually back then, like 20 years ago, they based most of their diet on grains. Now I think it's like 50% or a little bit less, but it is a lot of whole grains, and, you know, which is very different than the trend that's going on now, which is like less and less grains. But it's a really, really sort of nurturing diet, I think. And a lot of people that are sick eat, you know, macrobiotics, and it's helped so many different ailments, but like in cancer being one disease that a lot of people turn to macrobiotics just because it's so clean and pure. And there's not a lot of oil. Actually, they're kind of low in fat compared to how we're eating, what's sort of trendy now also. So I think it really influenced me. It's definitely not the way I approach food and cooking now, but I do have a strong influence from that. But yeah, which was first introduced to me from eating at this restaurant, which really was inspiring. And it was just so simple and, you know, one soup of the day and sort of one dessert they'd make, and they start, you know, they use agar and, you know, sweetened very lightly with usually like fruit juices, and everything was very clean and light. And I just started experimenting, and I also had roommates that were eating a macrobiotic diet too. So I just got to sort of cook with them and learn more, and I started experimenting with making these desserts because I just was like, you know, I was just very curious about it and just loved it. Actually, I think because I just felt good eating that way. But that led me to Amsterdam, where there I sort of went and sort of looked into maybe studying macrobiotics, and I found the Cushy Institute there. And I said, look, I need a job. Where can I work? And they said, oh, you should go to this restaurant called Shizen, which was just around the corner in the city in Amsterdam. And I went in and just got a job as a waitress because, you know, I couldn't really cook then. And and I sort of was with all these Japanese people and Dutch people, and English was the common language, so it was a great sort of first place. And the person I was staying with, an old family friend of ours, was like, oh, my God, that's my favorite restaurant. So I was so happy to sort of replicate everything that I learnt working there just from watching for her at home. So I got to practice a lot. And the food there really kind of got me like, wow, this is so – it's just so sort of centered and pure and clean and gentle. That's what it was. And – it was so beautifully presented, being Japanese too. So I really learned a lot about presentation there. And we did everything by hand. I mean, hand cutting all the fine daikon. And oh my God, it was like, so basically what happened was they saw my interest in food and said, oh, do you want to make the desserts? And then after I got like a lesson with one of these Japanese chefs that worked there, and then I sort of just was given the reins. Like, they didn't really watch me after that, after one little short class. And so I just started creating these desserts that I'd been, you know, starting to practice in Sydney. And I loved it. I mean, at first everything failed, and then after that it was trial and error, really. And I guess they were patient with me for a couple of rounds of things not working out, and then I just sort of found my stride, and they were really successful, and everyone was visiting just for the desserts, and they were selling out every night, and it was a very exciting time. So that was when I was like, oh, this is really fun. And then they were like, oh, why don't you start making the, you know, menu of the day and work in the kitchen? And then I really got some knife training, you know, on the job. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of how it started. But I did look into it when I got to Amsterdam, because I did think, you know, maybe it's something that I want to study. But always with me, it's been that I've just been sort of thrown in to a working situation. I've learnt as I've worked.
Mm-hmm. And learning as you go, and learning on the go, like on the spot, from people who make it their life's work is such a gentle, beautiful way to learn as well. So you're lucky.
Yeah, I am really lucky. I'm also a really hard worker, so I think they saw that I was, you know, just so diligent and so just so wanting to get it right, you know, and make beautiful food, that I feel like they just really appreciated that, which was great, which was really lucky for me.
Right, of course. And so from there, you went to London, and so you started a catering business, is that correct?
That's right. I mean, I'd moved there to open a restaurant, because we were like, oh, you know, there's no good vegan and vegetarian. I mean, by then I was kind of like, my friend in London, she was an amazing vegan cook before, you know, I was even in the kitchen. So she had great experience and had done a lot of catering. But we had just said, let's open a restaurant, and we'd sort of, you know, wrote this business plan and just spent all this time doing this sort of marketing and, you know, all these projections and trying to figure out where exactly we'd be and getting funding. And then we were just kind of like, we got offered this position, well, this kitchen in this art center in West London, and basically, you know, free kitchen and an office, and you just had to cater for every kind of workshop that was done there or wedding. And so it was kind of like built-in customers. So we took it and just kept doing that, and kind of realized, like, this is really fun. Like, do we really want a restaurant? that was quite a few years that we did that, which was great. And it was like a lot of holistic workshops, and they all wanted gluten-free and vegan, and so it was just right up our alley.
Mm-hmm. And so then what brought you to New York City?
Well, I met my partner and fell in love and was like, so, you know, I'd always loved New York, and I was like, oh, you know, do we want to stay here? Do you want to move over to London? And I was kind of feeling like I mean, of course, I just love New York. So that was the main, you know, we could have gone anywhere, but we really just, she lived here. And so I thought, let's move. I'll move. I'm happy to move. So I'd felt like I'd kind of reach my potential in London. I felt like I'd need to go through a whole new phase, whether it was like starting a different business or opening a restaurant. And I felt like I was really happy doing what I did there. So I kind of feel like I was ready to go.
Mm-hmm. So then you come to New York, and that's where you've stayed. You're still there.
Yes, I have.
And so then how did your career evolve once you arrived in New York?
I was really interested in working as a personal chef. I just love that idea of doing like specialized food for people on a small scale after catering, weddings, things like that. Mm-hmm. It was kind of like, oh my God, that's like a breath of fresh air just to do, you know, for a family. And there were so many people here that were, you know, vegan and vegetarian. It just didn't exist. There wasn't that sort of market in London. So I didn't even consider it an option. And I felt like in New York, things really opened up. Like I assisted a stylist, with food styling. And I felt like there was just like all these different options in food. It wasn't just restaurant or catering. And that's how I thought of it until then. So I worked in a little sort of restaurant as a pastry chef. And I sort of came in and I did, you know, their whole pastry line and learned a lot from what they were making. It's not around anymore. It used to be called Other Foods. And then I got offered a job at Angelica Kitchen. And that as a pastry chef as well. So it's sort of like always has been my way into a restaurant is through desserts.
Yeah.
Which is funny because, I mean, it's not like I ever really meant to focus on that, but I guess I was good at it. I loved doing it. And it was always a nice separate place in a kitchen. You know, it was almost like you can be more creative because you don't have to be balancing these meals and make sure it goes with the soup and the other special or, you know, all the other things that are on the menu. It's just like desserts. It's like you make three or four and it's like they stand alone, you know. So anyway, I was offered that and I worked as I was working for a personal chef, I also worked as a pastry chef there. And then they offered me executive chef position. So that was a long-term job, like the longest I've ever stayed anywhere. And it was great for me. It was amazing. It was a really great experience.
And Angelica Kitchen is one of New York's most prominent vegan restaurants, isn't it?
It is, yeah. It's been around, I think, the longest. I mean, I know there's some others that have been around a long time too, but Angelica's been there for like 35 years plus, I think. So, yeah. Right. And I'd heard about Angelica a long time ago, like when I lived in Amsterdam, people used to say to me, oh my God, your dessert's like Angelica. And I was always thought, oh wow, I can't wait to go to that place. Like that was, you know, 10 mm-hmm. years before I actually lived there and worked there. But so I felt like it was always on my radar. And finally, you know, got to experience it. And, you know, it's a really amazing place because it's sort of been doing farm to table local food for forever. And so it's very unique in that way.
And that actually, you just mentioning that reminded me of something that I wanted to ask you, because in your book, in the foreword, again, you do talk about that a little bit, about your experience at Angelica Kitchen and that you learned firsthand what it meant to build relationships with growers and how those relationships are really imperative to sustaining ethical business practices. So I wanted to hear, I mean, that's a huge part of my philosophy as well, but I was curious to hear your expanded thoughts on that and how it influences your cooking now.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think what I learned there was just how much we depend on them. I mean, like, because we don't have, well, there are, you know, obviously things that we got out of season. I mean, you just have to, you know, get so much in winter on the East Coast. But we would, you know, order from so many different farmers, someone who grows amazing greens and garlic and someone else who, you know, has peaches and nectarines and apricots in summer and, you know, and something else in spring or ramps or, you know, there was just so many. And it was actually a full-time job. So I had, there was actually two executive chefs there, and one that did all the ordering and dealing with farmers and staffing, and then me who did the creative menu planning and recipe development and product research. So it was sort of like shaped to really appeal to me, because at first I was like, oh my God, I can't take this on. It's such a huge responsibility, just because it's such a famous, you know, well-known place, and it's just so much to organize. So I mean, I guess through the owner, just like, you know, she's seen these farmers' kids go right through school and then they're in college. And, you know, she's just seen all their struggles. And I feel like what she did was help them out in times of need and vice versa. And so it really helped her business, maintain not only the high standards, but also just like through tough times. You know, like she was just so good at honoring the commitment, you know. And back when I first started working there, I remember one of the first stories I heard was her saying to some farmers in the Finger Lakes that if they built a root cellar, she would buy everything that they could store, you know, through the whole winter. And I just thought, wow, it's so amazing, like that a restaurant can actually sustain a farm, and not only one, like multiple farms. And I just realized, like, what an impact it can have. I mean, if she had friends, you know, back in the day, you know, when people were like moving out of the city and starting to grow organically, she was like, I'll buy everything you grow. And she could. It was such a privilege to have the vegetables, and so great to be able to do that. So I really, and just as a chef, I mean, it's just so awesome to be able to say, oh, we want to put, you know, this baby radicchio on our menu for Thanksgiving, and then have someone grow it for you, you know, and then just bring it in just picked, you know. It's like, it was just the freshest you could get, you know, fresher than even going to the green market where you have to like stop, you know, and sell it. It was like it would come directly. And so we were so lucky. And I always felt there that any time I was struggling with creative ideas or anything, I would just go and sit in the cool room with all the vegetables, because like every time I looked at them, I knew ideas would come. And that's sort of the way I got through the hardest times there, was in that cool room doing this, because I felt like, you know, they're just, everything was just so full of integrity and so carefully raised. So you really want to honor that as a chef.
And yes. Yeah, and sometimes, I mean, that's the way my husband, he's a food editor for Pure Green, and he creates all of the recipes, and that's the way he cooks too. It's just the food inspires you, and most of the time, you know, when you have a menu to plan, he doesn't know what he's doing ahead of time. He goes, and then the ingredients and the freshness of what's there, the vitality of a particular vegetable is what inspires him. So it sounds like it's the same for you.
Yeah, look, they speak to you, it's true. Like, you just have this sort of understanding like about what you need to make, and it's thank God, because I think that's when someone just says, oh, can you make a menu for I think, well, what? Like, you know, like, what? When is it? You know, like, you need so much more information than just making mm-hmm. a menu. And I feel like often I've been told, like, throughout my whole career, like, oh, what do you make? Like, don't you find that really restrictive doing vegan and local? And, you know, and it is. It's like, you know, vegan and local over here really narrows it down. But it's just really gives you that sort of something to bounce off and that leverage to be like, okay, this is the right thing to do. Otherwise, you can make anything, and it's, like, too broad. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's always been the way we did things there, actually. We'd get a fax from the farmer. You know, they're all faxes. And then you'd read the list and then create the menu and make a lot of adjustments constantly because, you know, everything changes as it does with some small organic farm, you know. So, yeah, it was a real creative challenge, and it was also really a learning experience just through the way that she does business. Leslie, the owner, she's so dedicated to doing things right and doing things that really benefit the restaurant and no one else, you know. So it was often the hard road, but it was really rewarding.
Mm-hmm. So that segues nicely into just talking about vegetables and freshness in nature. I'm curious, living in the city for all of your adult life, do you ever find that the contrast of that urban environment compared to the way you grew up difficult? Or how do you find ways to sort of still satisfy that inner childhood connection to the natural world?
Oh, no, I do find it hard sometimes. And I don't know, more and more lately, I think I need to spend more time outside. I just don't find the same kind of buzz maybe that I used to from just like the frenetic energy of a city. In fact, I keep away, so I think it might be time to make some changes. I don't think I'm ready to move like full time to the country, but I really think that it's the farmers market at Union Square that has just kept me connected. Like, it is the vegetables and the farmers and being able to get things that come directly from the earth not far away that really keeps me sane. I mean, and then cooking with it. And so I think that's why people feel so good about cooking, or like when I teach classes or I take clients to the green market, I feel like they just get so excited. And it's really is about that connection to nature that we just are starved of.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, your mention of the farmer's market, that is something, it reminds me of a question that I wanted to ask you a little later, but I'm going to jump ahead to it now. So I live in a really beautiful region of Ontario. I mean, I love living here. I'm surrounded by lakes and trees, and I'm really connected to nature. And I value it immensely. But despite this natural abundance that I have extremely limited access through the grocer to organic produce during the winter months when the farmer's market is buried in a blanket of snow. And it's always ironic to me that my friends or my contacts that I have in New York City or other cities have so much greater access to, you know, products. It's a bit of a, you know, to me it's a conflictive image, just that a huge city you get access to this great, you know, but it's the reality. So I'm curious, I make do the best of that I can, but what would you suggest for others in a similar position?
Right, like to stay, like to be able to get different produce. Is that what you mean? Like when you, or just to try to get inspired through cooking potatoes and onions. is that, I mean, you know, maybe you don't even have a farmer's market in winter, because here we have one in winter.
Yes.
And then there's still people growing amazing sprouts, you know, and some greens indoors, and then there's onions and root vegetables, you know, every kind you can imagine. I mean, they get a bit tired by February, but they're around.
Yeah, no, yes. I mean, it's basically when you have limited access to this abundance of fresh produce, what is the best way to sort of continue eating in this clean, healthful, nutritionally dense way?
Yeah, a well-stocked pantry. That is the key. I mean, because, you know, any time that – perfect example is when you come back from a trip and you have nothing in the house and it's dinner time and then you've got to think about the next day. I always just look to grains, beans, nuts. You can soak almonds and make almond milk. You've got chickpeas. You know, hopefully you can get some parsley the next day and mix them with chickpeas and, you know, cook some brown rice. And then I'm usually happy. See, I love eating simply. That might be the macrobiotic background. But, you know, I just, there's nothing nicer than a bowl of brown rice with some scallions and a bit of flax oil. But maybe you can't get flax oil. I don't know. Maybe you might have to do some mail ordering, which I'd love to do. But if you can't get access to, you know, a lot of these pantry items, even, because to stock your pantry, you still need like goji berries and, you know, some chia seeds or oats or whatever it is that you want to sort of have as the basis of your diet. You still, they can be hard to get too. But I really think the pantry, like dried seaweeds, they're a great way to, you know, to have vegetables, still a vegetable, in the colder months. And I do rely a lot on, like, when I'm really desperate, because often, even in New York, sometimes you're at this market and it's like, oh my God, there's nothing organic and it all looks really bad. You know, scallions and parsley that liven up any plain meal, you know. If it's a root vegetable soup, you put a whole lot of chopped parsley on top and it's like, you know, brightens it up. Mm. So I guess that's my sort of thing that I do is, you turn to your, you know, dried ingredients.
Right. Okay. So it reminds me of what you said earlier about when you were a child having to go to the city and stock up every month or every week or whatever you said.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's sort of similar.
Yeah, we would order a lot of stuff. Like, I think my mother organized a co-op for a period of time where she would order, you know, 50-pound bag of almonds and brown rice. And she still does it now, like, just to keep, you know, because actually there still is limited access where I grew up. You know, it's still, there's not going to be a well-stocked health food store within an hour and change drive. So so I think that it's something that people do everywhere, and it's so worth it because it stores so well for a long time, and it's actually so much fresher than anything that you find in some health food stores that don't have a high turnover. I mean, the stuff gets old. So sometimes just ordering bulk and sharing it with friends is a great way to, I mean, I even do it with things like vanilla. Because like even in New York, I mean, you know, you can buy these tiny bottles of vanilla. And for that book, I went through a gallon of vanilla. So,
yeah.
I'm very liberal with it, but.
Yeah. It's like me and maple syrup.
Right. Yeah. So you buy a huge thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we try and we haven't made it as a family for a couple of years, but we're trying to get back into it. So, we go through a lot. I wanted to move into now about your book and talk about that a little bit. But before I do, I wanted to ask you, what is your food philosophy? I know that's probably really hard to sum up, but just to give us that, just that perspective going into talking about your book, how would you describe your food philosophy?
Yeah, those broad questions I always find challenging.
I know, but they're good. I know, yeah.
I mean, my food... Well, I'm vegetarian, so I'm only really interested in a plant-based approach to food. I do supplement my diet with a little bit of dairy. That is mainly because I feel like I love to support these local farmers in the colder months. And when there's no, you know, not a big variety of vegetables, I really feel good about buying goat cheese and it's usually goat, maybe occasionally a bit of yogurt here and there, but often it's just for when I entertain, like to enrich food. It's a condiment. That's how I use it. So I've never cooked food with, you know, dairy inside. It's just not part of it. So really my diet is over 90% vegan, but I like the flexibility of being vegetarian so that I can, when I travel or when I go out, I sort of have, I'm not going to get ill from eating it, or, you know, my body's not used to it. So I just feel better not eating much of it. And that's a really long answer, but, I'm more interested in the whole food product than any sort of creative, amazing tasting, like vegan junk food or vegetarian fake meat. I've just never gone there. So it's not interesting to me because I've never eaten meat. So I actually have no idea what it should taste like or the texture. So it just doesn't appeal to me. And that's why I hate anything smoked. So people like, that's the only flavor I think I don't like. But other than that, I like everything. I mean, I just love all vegetables, grains, beans, nuts, seeds. There's really nothing I don't like. So my approach is pretty broad, but to a lot of people, being vegetarians narrows it down a lot, and then being vegan does. But because I've spent long periods of time cooking vegan food and coming up with, you know, menus and being creative and trying to make it local. I feel like that experience at Angelica really did influence me just really wanting to focus on what's available locally. And it's hard to be 100% and or even 90%, but I really think about, you know, the avocado that I'm eating. I think about, you know, it's not just sort of like, oh yeah, we need this and bananas. And I find it really hard to buy bananas.
I know, me too.
So, but anyway, yeah. I know that's a really long answer, but I feel like it sort of sums up, hopefully, was it clear enough? Like just that, even though I'm vegan and vegetarian, I'm pretty open to, you know, all different types of food. And I love the challenge of making things gluten-free, but I never want to use anything processed or anything that isn't a whole food while doing that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, it's a perfect answer. And I appreciate that flexibility because I know that people who may not eat that way, or I think it's just a general perception that eating that way or people who prescribe to that way of eating aren't necessarily flexible. And so I think it's refreshing and approachable and really nice.
That's great. So, yeah, and hopefully it can reach, you know, more with the book anyway. I really wanted it to be, you know, appealing to everybody, not just, you know, vegans and vegetarians. Like really like just a beautiful book with beautiful recipes. Whatever you eat besides that is, you know, up to you, of course.
Right. And you accomplished that.
Great.
Yeah, it's fabulous. So many authors will tell you that writing a book is hard and not necessarily the path to riches, but it does seem like a defining pivotal point in anyone's career. I mean, there's just something about it. It's just such a sense of accomplishment, I'm sure. I've never done it, but I'm sure. So was writing a cookbook something that you've always wanted to do?
Yes. You know, it's funny because I think I just got very busy with whatever I was doing, whatever job I was working at, that I didn't really make it my main priority. But when I left Angelica, I was really like, okay, like what's next for me? I need a book. Like I've been wanting to do one my whole career. I started photographing the desserts I made in the early 90s in Amsterdam. And you know, and it was like, I was building towards something, you know. I love that aspect. And then doing my blog kind of continued that and really gave me just that sort of sense, like I was already writing, because you're writing a post and you're writing head notes and writing a recipe. So it really excited me. And then the response that I started getting was also great. And I think it really sort of sealed it for me. I was sort of like I knew that I just had to do it and it had to be now. So and then it was like suddenly, it wasn't like I slowly started writing a proposal. It was like I just did it and then, you know, got an agent and then, you know, they shopped it around or whatever. But it was something I always wanted to do. I just hadn't focused on it before.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So what was the process like once you actually got the book?
It was hard. It was really hard. Oh, my God. That's so challenging. It's so much. I mean, I knew being a hard worker, like I said, I worked really hard and I knew it would be hard. I knew it would take a long time, but I had no idea just how hard or how much time. Like, but it was also a really thrilling experience because I felt like for the first time in my life, and I did this, like this is why it really wasn't a profitable experience for me so far, was that I really just stopped what I was doing and I looked at my whole life and reflected on, you know, these stacks of notebooks that I've sort of scrawled in my busy kitchen experience and they're, you know, splattered and you can't read half of them. But I basically went through, you know, my whole, this sort of history with food and started just cooking things that I'd never got a chance to make and things that I thought, and also things that I knew were winners and that I loved. And so started, you know, and it was just this sort of process of finding what was going to go into the book through cooking. So even though you'd think you'd have a book after 20 years of working over 20 years working in kitchens, but actually when it comes down to it, it's like, well, is this great? Is this really what I want it to be? Does this, you know, is this something that really represents, you know, what I love? So I just cooked and cooked and cooked. And so I love that part, you know, just developing the recipes and then writing the head notes was great. And, you know, but then when getting down to the pantry and all the nutritional all that information in there, you know, just was so much research and cross-referencing and fact-checking and doing it over and over again. And that was really hard for me because I'm so used to being on my feet and moving. So it was a totally different work phase for me. I mean, I didn't really know how to take care of myself when I'm stuck sitting down. You know, I didn't really realize how you've got to remind yourself to do this and move and yoga. And, you know, like, I just was sort of like, I have so much to do, and I'd just be sort of stuck just doing it. And, you know, and you have good and bad days.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's funny. That's one of my main challenges as well, because creating a magazine, my work is, it revolves around my desk. And you're right. I have to tell myself, okay, it's noon. Mm. Get up.
Yeah.
Go do something.
Yeah, having dogs helps. Because
yes,
they need a walk,
exactly.
And they look at you like, okay.
Yeah.
So that was good. But then I'd be out walking the dogs just deep in thought the whole time. And like, I have to get back and put this down or whatever. So, oh God. I just don't think you really ever get a break, even though in the 2.5 years that it took, there was periods where, you know, it's in your editor's hands and, you know, you're waiting to get it back or whatever. But then you're thinking about photo shoots and the cover and the, you know, just all these other things that are not done until they're done at the end, you know. So,
Yeah. And you did the photography as well?
I didn't. No. Johnny Miller, he's an amazing food photographer, did. And we did it all in our apartment, and I cooked all the food and styled it with the help of Stephen Johnson, who's the art director. He art directed the book and designed it. So we had this really great collaborative experience because I felt like we're all good at what we did, and then we just sort of came together, and it was just so much fun to do the shoots. They were intense because I was doing, you know, 13 recipes a day, testing them, you know, and styling. But it was really, really rewarding for me to be able to see my food and not worry about the photography and how it's being captured and what, you know, the light and everything. So,
yeah. Yeah. Wow. You did 13 shoots in a day?
Shots. Yeah.
Shots,
sometimes
yeah.
more. I mean, if we had, you know, a pile of beautiful looking eggplants, we'd, you know, photograph them, or squash, or, you know, I sort of had multiple amounts of ingredients and to get like some processed things. And, you know, we just did all sorts of stuff. But yeah, it was probably more times. But actually, the recipes, yeah, I really had to fit it all in. Yeah.
That's quite a feat. I mean, I know where we shoot the magazine, just our food section, it's called The Organic Kitchen. And at the studio that we shoot at, we do 5 shots and recipes, and they're always shocked because they work with a lot of really huge magazines, much, much larger than Pure Green. And they're like, whoa, we normally do 3. So I know to do 5 is a lot, and to do 13 is incredible.
Well, you know,
good for
okay,
you.
The difference is that if you're in the studio, like your house is the studio, you can prep things days before and then actually make something like a chia pudding, for example, 2 days before. So I would be cooking and prepping and shopping and going crazy for a week before the first day of shooting. And then I would have a soup made that, you know, didn't have to be freshly prepared that morning, but was already prepared, and I'd heat it up and then, you know, we'd style it and then eat it for lunch or whatever. So there was things like that. So I really was strategic when I looked at all the recipes, and we shot everything seasonally. So I knew I was just focusing on summer and, you know, or whatever. It was at the end of September. I'd be like, okay, there's so much recipes we can do. And I left anything that could be done any time of year, like a chia pudding, for example, till winter. So, so we sort of, I just looked at them all and thought, okay, what can I prepare ahead and what can we do next year, next summer? Because I actually thought we'd probably not be shooting again in summer, but there we were, you know, next year going, oh my God, I can't believe it's a year. I'm still shooting this book. But you know what it did? It did give me time in between to reflect on what the recipes were. And it sometimes I would be like, you know what? I don't think this needs to go in or change this. And, you know, it didn't change that much. I think I scrapped a couple of recipes that I was attached to for the wrong reasons. Like I love the head note or, you know, so, and it was like, actually, this isn't a great scone. And my sister just said, that sucks. It's horrible. It doesn't taste like a scone. You can't have it in. So I was like, oh, thanks. Well, I really hated it for it, but it was actually good advice. So, but then we hadn't photographed it. So long answer is that, yeah, you can prepare ahead a lot, and, you know, when you live where you're shooting. But with you, you're probably going there just for the day, and so the food stylist has to cook everything from scratch, and that's, like, a lot of pressure.
Yeah, that's Jonathan. Yeah. He's a food stylist, too.
Right.
So it's a lot. It is a lot.
And you need help, yeah. And then you're in a different stove and pots and la la, and it's so much better. I'm so grateful that we could shoot it here. Because it just felt right. And then I'm not, like, you know, in this strange environment, and, you know, ovens are different, and, you know, so that.
Yes, the oven. That's Jonathan's big thing.
Oh, my God, the oven. Yeah. It can really throw you off. You need to get a thermometer. Does he have one?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay, good.
Yes.
Because I really recommend that. I did that with mine, too, just to make sure it was accurate to test the recipes. But it's so hard. And I do this with my clients. I mean, I'm cooking in all these different kitchens, and it takes a few weeks to get used to an oven. So,
It does. Yeah. I know. So what was it like to hold your book for the first time, printed and done?
Oh, it was a funny feeling. It was just like, I think you think about it and you try to picture it, like what it's going to look like too, because actually I feel like I think it was maybe a year that I knew what the cover was, the last almost a year, but just the way it's all going to come together, even though you see it, you can't quite picture exactly what it's going to be like. And I was nervous. I was nervous and excited and kind of a bit like, I felt a bit like, I don't know, like I wasn't really in my body.
Yeah.
And it took a while to be excited. Like I was kind of just like, this is thing. And I was like, do I want to look? And I kind of flicked and I was excited and I posted something on Instagram because I was like, oh, I was just sort of so excited. But then when I started looking at it, I was like, oh my God. And mostly I wasn't exactly happy at first, but I was just, as it settled in and I look and I actually use it. That's the weird thing. Like I look up something like, how did I do that?
Yeah.
There, you know, and so I thought, oh, this is a good sign. I'm using my own book. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I could appreciate that. I mean, every quarter we produce a new issue of the magazine and, you know, you pour so much of yourself into it, so much more than people realize. And then when you finally hold that copy, it's like a thesis. You feel like you could have continued working on it forever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's really important to have that, that stop point. It's really hard though.
I mean, it is.
You can just, yeah, change and change and change. I mean, there was, especially for me with the recipes, my editor told me to stop because I had like another, you know, bunch of ideas and she's like, oh, I think you need to start writing. So I'm glad she said, because I was like, oh my God, when I started, I just realized like writing an introduction is so hard. You know, there was just so many things that just sort of took months to really kind of come about, you know? So,
yeah. So I wanted to move on to the contents of your book. And you mentioned earlier that the pantry section was a lot of work. And, you know, I'm really glad that you put that work into it because it's almost my favorite part in a way. I mean, the recipes are fantastic, but the reason I really like the pantry section is because it strips away the uncertainty for a novice or for even for someone choosing to eat cleaner or more wholesome foods, and helps us truly feel at home in the kitchen, as your title suggests. Because then all of those, you know, you're not reading the recipes wondering, well, how do I do that? Or where do I get this? Or, you know, you just start with the right ingredients. You're starting on the right foot. Mm. And so I really appreciated that.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. No, I'm glad because it's so much of the book grew from that. And then that was written sort of after the recipes. So it was sort of like a two-way thing, but I'm really glad. I'm so happy to have it down too. I mean, there's so much to learn about all those ingredients and you could really go on forever adding information. But I guess the way I approached it was like, what makes me want to eat goji berries or brown rice? You know, what, you know, is it the blood cleansing properties of brown rice that makes me want to eat, or is it the B vitamins, or, you know, and just putting that information in there to remind me. That's sort of, you know, I started this on my website. I give away a pantry stocking list and there's just like one line about brown rice. It's very simple, which is sort of how we grew that in the book. But it was just that thing of like, what inspires me to cook and what inspires me to buy these ingredients, you know, and seek them out, you know, over everything else. And so I wanted it to be, because I'm not a nutritionist or a doctor, and I wanted it to be that sort of what I teach, the way I teach my clients, which is, and how do I get them in the kitchen? How do I inspire them to cook, you know?
And I mean, in our kitchen as well. I mean, we have a lot of experience around food too, but it was the same thing. It was a fantastic reminder for me. And one of the things that I learned that I didn't previously know was about soaking grains, like why you do it. For some reason, I had always thought that it was just to speed things up, you know?
Right, Which it sort of does. It can do. I mean, with beans and really hardy grains, yes, but I still find I cook them for quite a while. But yeah, and a lot of people do it to speed it up.
Mm-hmm. But there's a whole other reason. So can you tell us what that is?
There is. That's phytic acid, which is, I think some people have been confused by it, but basically anything with the skin, a grain, a bean, a nut, or a seed, contains this nutrient blocker called phytic acid that prevents these seeds from, or grains, or beans, or nuts, from sprouting in your pantry. So you need to release it. It inhibits, sort of an enzyme inhibitor too, like it will stop you from absorbing all the benefits you're going to get from this whole grain or bean or whatever. So if you soak it, it goes into the water, the soaking liquid. So it's really important that you don't just cook the grain in that same water. You need to strain it off, rinse it thoroughly, drain it again, and then put fresh water and cook it. And it will help the grain or the bean become more digestible as well. So not only are you preventing this blocker from stopping you from absorbing the nutrients, you're digesting more easily. And I just noticed personally and, you know, with my clients, like how much better they felt. One other thing about soaking is that it ignites the sprouting process. So if you're eating an almond that's soaked, it's the most nutritious that almond is going to be in its life. I mean, if a seed or a nut actually grows a sprout, that's like, nutrition powerhouse. This is why people sort of went crazy for sprouts in the 70s. I mean, they really are nutritious. So soaking things starts that process, because before you sprout anything, you have to soak it overnight. Before you want to grow a tree, the seed has to be soaked overnight and before it can grow a sprout. So there's so many reasons to do it. Plus, I think everything tastes better. I actually think brown rice, like the way I cook it in the pantry recipe, is just the best tasting brown rice. And I don't know if it's the combination just with the sweet rice or whatever and the way it's soaked, but it is for me, the ideal texture. It's a little bit sticky, moist, and you feel great after eating it.
Mm-hmm. I think the trick for me, and probably for a lot of people, is I'm a terrible planner. And I tend to go, Jonathan and I would cook each day with what do we feel like making, you know? And so
I have that too, absolutely. Because that's the way you got to cook, right? And because your husband's a chef. You can still do that. So the thing is just getting into this habit of blindly soaking whatever you have. Like, don't even think, do I want quinoa or brown rice? Think, what did I have last time? It doesn't matter. I'm just going to soak. Oh, what bean looks appealing? What do I need to use up? What do I have the most of? How do I have enough for a soup? Is this enough for three of us? Whatever you're cooking. So just do that and soak whatever you see. And just soak it and go to bed or make your dinner or whatever. I usually do it when I'm making dinner because it's like, oh, I'm waiting for this to boil. Oh, let me soak something for tomorrow. And then those chickpeas, say you chose chickpeas because they're delicious, you soak like quite a bit if there's three of you eating and you know you like them. And then you, tomorrow at some point in your day, it doesn't matter when it is, as long as they've soaked for 10 to 12 hours, you cook them. And then you may not even get to eat them, but they cool down, you put them in the fridge in a jar, and then you eat them the next day or the day after, or I put them in a salad or I might add them to a soup or I need a quick snack and I'll just mash them up with a bit of olive oil and put them on a rice cake. You know, so they're there, I mean, they're delicious to snack on. So it's just like having them there so that you will have something nutritious to eat. It's like it's like convenience. And then look, you know what, if you don't eat them, so you've got like 3 to 4 days to eat them, you can always freeze them. I don't really ever do that. I actually just did it for the first time recently. And just, you know, I know a lot of people do it, but they're frozen and cooked and then you can just like, you know, warm them up to eat them. So you really can't go wrong. I sort of feel like doing the same thing with a grain. And sometimes I just do both. When I get home from a trip, I'm like, I've got nothing. So I'm just going to cook two things. Next day I cook them. Okay, one's lunch, one's dinner. And I'm fine for the next 2 days, 3 days. But then around the bean or the grain, that's when you say, what do we feel like? Do we feel like having a salsa on this with something Mexican? Or do we feel like just having, you know, something really simple, or does it want to be a stew? And then you can sort of use it to help you decide what you feel like.
Right. Yeah, that's a really good way to look at it.
Yeah, it's just the basis. That's the thing. It's just the basis. We want to eat more vegetables, right? You don't want to just be eating grains and beans, but it's the basis of the beginning of a meal, you know.
So I'm curious, do you have a favorite recipe in the book? Or put it, because I know that's a really hard question, put another way, if someone were to prepare just one thing from the book, what would you suggest?
Well, right now, I'd probably want them to make something that I didn't really feel like making that was more effort, like the chickpea. We're just talking about chickpeas. So I love that spicy chickpea stew.
Mm-hmm.
It's so good on its own, or with a bit of kraut, or a little bit of yogurt, or the grain, or all three things. It's really delicious. I would probably have them make that.
Yeah, that's on my list of things to make.
It is.
Yeah, but I'm going to make it less spicy so that my little girl, she's 20 months old,
yeah,
can,
you know,
enjoy
that
it too.
The thing in that recipe is you stir in the harissa at the end, so you can actually eat it without it, and it's still good. So,
Yeah, it looks really good. So who were the most important culinary influences in your life, would you say?
Well, my mother still is. I mean, my mother is a great cook, and we still have a connection through food and talk about it on the phone a lot and cook a lot when we get together. She's less and less interested in cooking, so she just loves it when I cook, and she'll support me 100% in that. So that's a major influence. And she had a friend who was a chef and had a catering business and actually ended up working at Iku, my favorite macrobiotic restaurant. So she and I was often in the kitchen with her. Her and my mother used to sort of have elaborate parties and do things. So I was often there with them and in the kitchen. And I remember her saying to me when I was pretty young, like I was probably under 10, I remember her saying, "You really know how to move around in a kitchen." And I thought, oh, I didn't know there was a special way. And I really valued her, just her taste. She's just got great taste, and she's everything she does is gourmet. And my mother is pretty gourmet too with what she does. I think she's sort of gotten more and more simple and eating cleaner and cleaner as she's gotten older. But her friend, makes croissant and does things from scratch and sort of just is very passionate a person about life, actually. So probably my mother and her, Lynn, really, influenced me. Just sort of sparked my interest, I think, in food.
Mm-hmm. I'm always so shocked at how quickly time goes in these because I'm just so interested. But so I'll move into the last couple of questions. But one of the things that I remember reading and you mentioned at the very beginning was this idea of an element of celebration in the food with which you were raised that way. And I really loved that. To me, it conjured up images of dancing in the kitchen and eating food with a reverence for the ingredients, the land in which they were grown, and even the love they were harvested and prepared. So how does this element of celebration manifest in your cooking today?
I think any time I'm given beautiful produce, I feel like I have a responsibility to bring out the best in it. If I'm going to touch it and cook it and, you know, eat it, it's sort of like, oh, wow, what's the best thing we can do with that? And often that is just something special, you know, even if it's simple. And I guess that does bring an element of celebration. And the fact that I want to share it with people, and nothing gives me greater pleasure than sharing food. And often in our busy lives, it's like, you know, a jar of soup to my neighbor or to my sister or whatever. But I feel like whenever I make something great, I just want to share it. And, you know, and it's usually something that is, always something that's grown with, you know, care and integrity, which comes from the green market. So, or a local farm, or, you know, something that I've had a connection to. So I think it's that feeling of first it comes from like responsibility in a way. And then if it's something great, then I just really want to share it or show someone how to make it or, you know. Yeah. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it does. It just, about taking joy in the ingredients. And in the process of eating too, I think I'm guilty of this. I'm so hungry or I'm busy or whatever, and things just, you wolf it down. And so trying not to do that every so often, I think, is celebrating food as well.
Yeah, and I think every meal can, just having that moment, eating a meal that's good, and I feel like I sort of try to make that effort, no matter how simple it is. It's just like, it's got to be delicious, you know? It's got to be like, I've got to be excited about it. I mean, I've really got to be rushed if I'm not excited, you know? But I feel like I do feel like my life revolves around food. I mean, it really does. Whether, it's not about eating a large amount, but it's just about, really enjoying it and feeling good. You always feel so much better when you eat well. And I guess celebrating that is a really nice pause to take in your life. Gathering people around food is such a nice way to be together.
Exactly. I love that. And it segues super nicely into the next question that I had, which is about the holidays, because we're moving into the holiday season. We're pretty well in it. And so I wanted to know, what are your favorite traditions? And as a vegetarian, how does a holiday meal at your table take shape?
Well, Christmas Day in Australia seemed to be celebrated by everyone we knew, and just not for religious reasons, but because it was a day in summer, so it's really hot. And you get together with sort of like when I was younger, and still now when I go back, it's the families that I grew up around, and people seem to come back, and we sort of set up a big table, and I feel like everyone sort of makes their thing. Like, no one person tries to do everything, but people make their specialties. Someone makes dolmades and someone else makes pierogies. And, this is like all these different food things that I remember from growing up. So here it's another story, though. And if I'm not always back in Australia at Christmas time. So with my partner, have come to sort of have this sort of tradition of Christmas Eve dinner. Because it's actually something so festive. I love it. I love the sort of the nighttime and the candles and long winter night. So we do Christmas Eve dinner at our house and invite a lot of people, and it's family visiting from Australia, my sister, her partner, and neighbors and friends. And I'm fine if someone wants to make something, meat or fish, but actually I'm happy to cook and make it vegetarian. So I'm often doing, I change it up, but, I just really look to the farmer's market again, and, now there's all these amazing root vegetables, and so there's something that I've done with this sort of stuffed, well, it's like a hollowed out acorn squash, and then made this sort of lentil, mushroom, herb, chestnut kind of stewy-like thing that gets ladled into the squash, and when you eat it, you kind of eat it with the soft squash flesh, and a great combination of flavors, and you can put some wine in there, and yeah.
Sounds good.
It's yummy. And they always involve heirloom beans. Christmas is always the time I like get out some special heirloom bean that I've ordered or whatever, and people go crazy for them. Last year I marinated these big white beans, Corona beans, and no one could just believe how good a bean could taste, and they were so simple, but it was like a side dish. So
yeah,
that usually comes into it too.
Yeah, yeah, we have the same tradition. It's all about Christmas Eve.
Right. Yeah, I like that.
So do I. It's just, it just feels, it's anticipatory, but it's just a way of kicking it off. It just feels so great.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, Christmas Day is usually a bit hectic, and there's a bit of traveling involved sometimes, and it's just, it's kind of nice to make the Christmas Eve the big hurrah.
Yeah, and something about winter, I think, too, because there it's like, the morning and it's bright sun and you just want to get up and be outside, whereas here it's just a different feeling, so it's kind of nice to be low-key on Christmas Day.
Yeah, for sure. So last question of all, what are you working on for 2015, and where can listeners go to follow you on a regular basis?
They can go to my website, amychaplin.com. And I hope to be doing a lot more posting there. It's just sort of a little sporadic, but I really try to put a post off every week, so hopefully I'll be able to stick with that in 2015. I have sort of some things on the burner, nothing solidified. So there's nothing really to announce, but I really would like to look at being able to reach more people with what I do through larger cooking classes, TV work and you know, in that kind of way, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I know it's a bit vague, but
but no, it's good.
Yeah, that's sort of the way I feel like right now. I'm just like very like one-on-one with my clients, and then I have, you know, these outlets online, which is like Right for the Food Network, their Healthy Eats blog, and also my own, and then, you know, doing these sort of recipes here and there for magazines and things like that, which is great. But I'd like mm-hmm. to be on a more consistent basis to be able to share with people, you know, how to cook, not just sort of recipes. And I feel like, you know, really what, you know, just really encouraging people to get into the kitchen, because I really think it's the answer to so many of our problems is mm-hmm. cooking more.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, no, it, and you know, you've just culminated this massive project, so it's natural to just take a beat and then move into the
next
big thing.
Yeah.
So, yeah, exactly. Well, thank you, Amy, so much. I can't thank you enough for taking this time to talk with me, and I'm really excited to share this with our listeners. It's going to be fantastic.
Oh, thank you. It's such an honor. Thanks so much for having me on.
So that was my interview with Amy. I really hope you enjoyed it. Head on over to puregreenmag.com/podcast/Amy for detailed show notes and timestamps to help you navigate the show, as well as a sneak peek inside Amy's book. If you've enjoyed the show so far, don't forget to subscribe in either iTunes or Stitcher, and tell a friend. More listeners equals more fun. This podcast is created by Pure Green Magazine. Go to puregreenmag.com to pick up a copy or to subscribe. Thank you again for listening. See you next week.